Dictators love to bloviate. Fidel Castro could speak for hours. Mussolini's speeches from palace balconies made for memorable black and white newsreel footage. But what if someone compiled all of the written works of the world's worst despots and dictators? This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton has just such an author, and that interview begins now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening, as always. Okay, let me open the kimono on these next segments. They don't have a ton to do with economics, and probably even less to do with technology, but the subject matter was simply impossible for us to pass up. The cast of characters are very familiar to all of us. The effects they had on humanity, the world economy, and the people they oppressed are undeniable. They're dictators, and their literature sucks. Not this book and author we're about to hear. I mean the words that the dictators wrote in their books is, as the subtitle to the book says, a catastrophe.
And so they were writing these theories down with the anticipation that they would come to pass. And then, you know, they came into power, and it proved it was much more difficult to bring about utopia on Earth than had previously thought. So then I think they then attempted to just overwrite reality.
When the best example of dictator lit is Benito Mussolini, the man who seems to have invented circular breathing while speaking, well, it's a treasure of research and storytelling. Okay, here we go.
Daniel Calder, author of The Infernal Library.
I was thinking about this when I was reading the book. I had to read in college a book titled The Banality of Evil. It seems like you had to read the entire genre of The Banality of Evil for this book. I mean, how long did this take?
It took about 8 years, all told. Maybe even longer, because I first started reading about dictator books in the early 2000s when I discovered Saddam Hussein had written a romance novel. But I got really serious about it in 2008, 2009. And I discovered that nobody else had really plowed their way through all of these terrible books. So I thought, well, if no one else had done it, then I guess I should. So I took that duty upon myself. finding the books was hard sometimes. You know, I mean, I had to go into research libraries or track down obscure secondhand copies. And then they were physically difficult to read because they were so, for the most part, so awful. And so you can't just, you know, sit down and they're not page turners. You have to really take your time to get through them.
I'm glad you self-appointed yourself for this. And you're right. I wanted to ask about the source material right up front. Did you have any problems finding things in, I don't know what languages you may read in. You speak English, obviously. You read English. But did you have trouble finding translations?
Well, the interesting thing about a lot of these dictators, well they were megalomaniacs or even messianic megalomaniacs. They thought they were the saviors of humanity. And so a lot of them translated their texts into English. So the communists in particular, even really obscure communists, they thought that this was like a world, almost like it was a new faith for the world. This would solve the world's problems. So even really obscure guys like Enver Hoxha of Albania was translating his works, his memoir of him side by side with Stalin into English and then distributing it around the world. So it's kind of, I guess, secondhand book warehouses in the internet are, you can find these things scattered around. Uh-huh. Other pieces, some of them are online. So, I mean, obviously Mein Kampf is kind of spread around the world like a virus. Uh-huh. But some of them were very difficult. So the Mongolian dictator Choibalsan, it was really difficult getting his stuff. Some of Mussolini's more obscure pieces I had to import. I can read Russian, so sometimes I would read like a Mongolian translated into Russian, for mm-hmm. example.
I see. I want to get into the weeds about some certain dictators. We won't have time to cover all of them. That's why you have to read the book. If you're listening, you really have to read the book. But it does seem that dictators believe that their words can somehow like force a reality. I think at one point you decide, or you wrote, define and control a reality. Was that like a unifying theme around most of these publications?
Yeah, I think that's a major theme. And so I think at first they had immense faith that what they were writing was true, maybe more true than reality. So like they saw the truth of history, and so they were writing these theories down with the anticipation that they would come to pass. And then, you know, they came into power, and it proved it was much more difficult to bring about utopia on Earth than had previously thought. So then I think they then attempted to just overwrite reality. And so you can see, especially with Stalin, there were multiple histories of the Soviet Union, and he kept killing people. And so then he would just revise these histories. And I was like, all of that stuff you remember didn't happen. You know, this book contains the truth of what happened. Even if your memory is different, I'm telling you now, this is what happened.
Right.
And then, you know, they would look around and they could perceive their own misery, but they would be told that they were happy and that they were a successful country. And so there was this real, almost aggression. It was like the book was more powerful than reality. And if you disagreed, then you would be just forced to admit it,
right,
even if you didn't think so.
Yeah, and you mentioned Stalin specifically right there, and it reminds me of the epigraphs that you chose for the book as well. One of them is Stalin, that the writer is the engineer of the human soul. We're back to the forcing a reality on people, right? Every dictator had a little writer in him, and I think every writer had a little dictator in him. And one of your blurbs, I think, from the book, the author of Blitzed, which was one of my favorite books of 2016, said that too. I know it's lazy to rely on blurbs, but that one really stood out to me. Is that what you found too, that there's a little bit of writer in every dictator and vice versa?
I mean, a lot of the dictators were writers for a long time before they were dictators. So, you know, Lenin and Mussolini were both writers for at least 2 decades before they came to power.
Mm.
And most of their lives were spent as writers. And I think they were egomaniacs, and they were convinced that they had the answers, even if their own answers changed. And so that requires a kind of, you know, monumental ego. And then they become more so than your standard writer. But I think it was Charles Bukowski said something about the problem with a writer is if, you know, if you tell him he's no good, then he thinks he's a genius. And and if he can't sell his book, then he really thinks he's a genius. Writing is hard, and to get to the end of any book requires a degree of self-belief. But these guys take it to a whole other level.
No doubt. And in phase one...
A terrifying level.
Terrifying, exactly. Phase one of your book is called The Dictator's Canon. Lenin, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler, and Mao. And also, again, you have an epigraph from Hitler says, "I am not a writer." But he was a writer. Of those five that you put in part one of your book, obviously they're the five pillars of terrorism and oppression. Which one stood out to you as a writer, strictly as somebody who's trying to perfect a craft?
In the early days, I would say Mussolini. He was a skilled writer, there's no doubt about it. He was a very talented journalist. And even one of his books, I say in the book, his war diary, I think it borders on being a good book. It tells you something about the war that isn't just propaganda, it contains truth. Mm. So him to some degree. I mean, Stalin as a teenager was apparently quite a good poet, but he gave it up, and then his work's just become very instrumental. But Chairman Mao, I mean, his stuff is atrocious. But he did write poetry through his entire life, and I think he took that poetry seriously. Whether or not we need to take it seriously is another question, but they weren't just, you know, propagandistic declarations. They made reference to classical Chinese poetry. I mean, he was a well-read guy, and so there was at least an effort in there. I don't read Chinese. In English, it comes across as very boring and pompous to me, mm-hmm. but I think he was serious about writing poetry.
One of the great things about this book is a walk through history from a different angle that's never been done before, which is exactly what you said at the top of the interview is why you wanted to write the book. Are you trained as a historian?
No, I studied literary criticism, so I took that and then applied it to the dictator
okay.
books. But I mean, I've read a lot of history.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I kind of want to drill into one thing that kind of stood out for me because I've studied a bit on the Spanish Civil War and the Iberian Peninsula. I didn't know enough about Portugal, which is in here too. Was that a new area for you as well, or is just my blind spot?
No, it was. I think that was for me. I mean, I knew about Franco, General Franco.
Right.
But it was Salazar really caught me off guard. And in fact, I was talking to my father about the book, and he goes, "Oh, have you done Salazar?" I was like what? And so he was this Portuguese dictator, and he was there for a very, very long time and wrote a lot of stuff. You know, I think one of the reasons that he sort of falls off the radar is because he was sort of very insular. I think, you know, some of these dictators, if they don't have grandiose dreams of conquering other countries, you can kind of get away with it for a very long time if you don't bother other countries around you. So Salazar, I mean, he was a kind of Catholic nationalist, and so he was an economist by training. And so I think he never got carried away with, like, humongous messianic dreams. His goal was to have a kind of orderly state, and he was kind of, although he was kind of nationalist, he was like, he wasn't a fan of the Nazis, so he never crossed these lines and went into these dangerous areas that would draw attention on, like, a relatively small country.
And by comparison to other dictators, you said he was kind of controlled and economist by trade. What was his writing like?
It was controlled. So, I mean, he wrote these aphorisms. I mean, his aphorisms are very sort of, you know, first when I read them, they read like Mussolini light, like kind of fascism light. But then, you know, you could also just read them as sort of like, maybe just like traditionalist Catholic nationalist stuff. So kind of reading in a different context, it came across as different. So, yeah, but I mean, there's nothing in there that's particularly scandalous. Although, I mean, T.S. Eliot, great poet of the 20th century, was, I think he actually organized for the publication of Salazar's, one of his books in English. So he had his fans. Yeah. Among some very influential cultural people in the 1920s and 30s.
I seem to remember you mentioned that Jean-Paul Sartre had an affinity for a dictator as well, didn't he, towards the end of his life?
I think he sold Maoist newspapers on the streets.
Right.
I mean, there's a long and shameful litany of intellectuals who carried water for dictators. I mean, like George Bernard Shaw, he sort of went to the Soviet Union during the famine, and he said, oh, I've never eaten so well in all my life, you know, and Foucault, he wrote some very dubious stuff about Ayatollah Khomeini in the 1970s. Garcia Marquez, he was given a mansion by Fidel Castro. So there's a kind of close relationship between dictators and real writers, good writers.
A couple of macro questions for you, if I could. Of course, we're speaking with Daniel Calder. He is the author of The Infernal Library on Dictators, the Books They Wrote, and Other Catastrophes of Literacy. The books they wrote were not all nonfiction, right? They were not all manifestos. Who wrote some fiction and why?
I mean, Mussolini was probably the first to write fiction, but he wrote it before he was the dictator. So he was like a jobbing journalist, and he wrote this serial for a socialist newspaper. This was before he was a fascist. And so, I mean, I think he wrote it for money, you know? I mean, he wrote for cash, and so it was like they would publish installments, and it was a kind of, like what they call a bodice ripper. And then once he became dictator, he wasn't particularly keen on this book being available, so it was actually, I think it was easier to find in the United States than it was in Italy. Mm. But then, I mean, Franco wrote a novel which was like a screenplay, a kind of civil war, and I think for him that was a way of maybe, and that was turned into a movie, and so I think maybe they knew some of their ideas were maybe not digestible in pure theoretical form, so let's try and write it in a popular form. I mean, Lenin in the Soviet Union was a big fan of the cinema. He didn't write movies, but he thought that this way we can reach the masses, so there was always a desire to reach the masses. And then Saddam Hussein, at the end of his days, he wrote a couple of novels, and right up until the end of his regime, he was just kind of stuck in his office cranking out these novels, and
wow.
I read one of them, and I think, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, on the face of it, it's this terrible romance novel, but there's like long discourses about how the leader is disconnected from the people, and how can the leader connect to the people, and this woman is teaching this king how he can reconnect with the masses and embody them, and so I think they would sometimes turn to these forms to popularize their ideas or to speak directly. But maybe in their heart of hearts, they knew that nobody was really plowing through thousands of pages of speeches, so they would choose these more popular forms.
They have captive audiences, by definition, if they're dictators and they're publishing. Do they give themselves royalties, or do they look for profit off of this?
Some of them did. I mean, I think Hitler collected royalties. He got really rich off of Mein Kampf. And I'm pretty sure Mao also collected royalties. Not sure about some of the others. I don't know if like Stalin did,
right.
But definitely a number of them enriched themselves by forcing these books on the masses. Hitler definitely did,
right.
And Mao. I think there was some, even Mao's royalties were still piling up in the 1990s, and the Communist Party had to decide if they were going to distribute them.
Okay, what about acolytes? Let's say if you're a satellite or a puppet leader of a state in the Soviet constellation of nations. What was your role there? Were you given books to write, or were they written for you under your name and they just kind of had to stick to the program that was being laid out by Stalin, for example?
There was a lot of the early satellite leaders had been revolutionaries in their own countries and they'd published stuff. And the Bulgarian guy, Dimitrov, he actually went on trial in Nazi Germany, accused of burning the Reichstag, and he published a very interesting diary about it. But then once they were in power, they had practically no agency, no liberty to define the theory. The rules were laid down at the center.
Mm.
I mean, it's not like the early works are super amazing, but you can tell they were written by human beings. But then later on, it's almost like by this committee, this kind of machine language, and
yeah.
They're very concerned not to step outside the boundaries of what is acceptable.
Right.
And in North Korea, you can see almost three generations of repetitive language now. Of Kim Jong-un is using some of the same terminology that Kim Il-sung used. I mean, Stalin had a direct phone line to those guys. So if any of them crossed out a line, they couldn't call him, but he could call them. Although on the face of it, they had a lot of power. They, you know, they lived in terror of the real boss.
Let's stay with Kim Jong-un for a second, because I was going to close with that, but we're here. He hasn't been in power terribly long. Has he been producing fiction, fiction or nonfiction?
I don't know about fiction, but he certainly cranked out theoretical essays. I mean, mm-hmm. I put theoretical in inverted commas. So, I mean, he produces things about, you know, they're still going forward, you know, fighting, you know, America. And the struggle to, there's a permanent struggle to reach whatever the end goal of the regime is, but they've been, there's a struggle that's been going on since, you know, the 1940s now. And
is one of the unintended consequences of this type of literature literacy for maybe the populace or people under a dictatorship?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah. Maybe not even unintended. So, you know, like Russia and China, before the regimes were in place, there was like mass illiteracy. So literacy campaigns were a huge part of those regimes. And then once they were taught how to read, they had to be given stuff to read. And so what they were given was produced according to the rules of the regimes. And I think some of the Soviet republics, so it wasn't just Russia, there was other places. It was almost like they acquired alphabet at the same time as communism appeared. There was all oral literature up to that point. Mm. And so they acquired alphabets, but then simultaneously they acquired these terrible books. And so it's strange to think your way into that, because, okay, it's great, we can all read now, but what have we got to read? Oh, we've got to read Comrade Stalin's books. So it's a strange situation. But suddenly there's a new ideology, so they can't really read this stuff anymore, and so they're back to year zero. So it's kind of strange situations.
I'm going to end with a squishy question, because you pioneered this. Nobody has put together a compendium of the literature and publications of different dictators through history. You are a literary critic. You're also a reporter, and you've written essays for many magazines. What were some of your takeaways that came from your research? And you said it took about 8 years to do all of this. It's a long time. You must have pulled together something that was truly an aha moment.
The thing that really struck me was, you know, we think of Hitler or Stalin, Lenin. These are like notorious names, right? They're legends, infamous. But they were completely obscure, these guys, for very long periods of time. And I think, you know, 100 years ago, looking at these guys, you think, they're nothing. Nothing's going to happen here. These books are practically unreadable. And yet it was like how quickly these obscure authors with their unreadable text could, given the right circumstances, they could kind of shift to the center and seize power. And suddenly these like unreadable books that were very unpopular were almost sacred texts. So I was really struck by repeatedly how quickly that happened, and I guess how, you know, history turns on a dime or whatever. Mm-hmm. And also it can be, you know, when civilization loses confidence in itself, I think, is when it's this kind of ripe time for these kind of false prophets, if you will, to rise to the fore. But it was just how quickly, and I think too, it's like how significant these countries are. It's not like this was happening in like really obscure places. I mean, you know, like right. If you think about Russia or Germany or China, I mean, these are like massively influential cultures, or China's an ancient civilization. So, and yet, you know, this craziness happened, and it lasted for decades in some instances. So it was, I guess, a kind of cautionary tale.
Yes.
We should look out for this.
You are not an obscure author, Daniel Calder. The Infernal Library is a marvelous book. I encourage everybody to read it. Thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for writing the book.
Thank you very much.
That was author Daniel Calder. His new book is titled The Infernal Library, on dictators, the books they wrote, and other catastrophes of literacy. For links to Mr. Calder and his book and his site, check out the show notes for this week. They live at kgoradio.com. The Dictator Lit was a little too fun to pass up, but we will get back to the tech and the onomics back in next week's show, because that's it for this week's show. The Imagineers of War and the Infernal Library of Dictators. Kind of. I'm at KGO Jason if you're on the Twitter. We're also at facebook.com/techonomicsradio and online, of course, kgoradio.com. For producer Liana Wilcox and executive producer Mike Anthony, I'm the writer and the host, Jason Middleton. Thanks for listening, and have great weeks, everybody.